All right, welcome back to another episode of What's Going On with Earl Ingram. You know, we're about to go on an amazing journey. I've had great opportunities to interview a lot of different people in my life. And this trek that we're about to go on is a historical journey from a history maker, a man that I've grown to admire. Didn't know much about him, I'd say 8 years ago, but I know a lot about him now. And I'm so honored and privileged to bring before you one of the surviving members of the Negro Baseball League, and one who is really the archival historian who carries the history of all of those great men who were great ball players who really, in many instances, people don't know about. So when we begin this journey, hopefully by the end of it, many of you who may not know anything about the Negro League will certainly know more about it than you ever thought you ever would, because there isn't anyone around who can give it to you like my guest, Mr. Dennis Biddle. Good morning to you, my friend. How you doing?
I'm doing fine, Earl.
It's always good to see you.
Yeah, I'm always blessed by the best. And you, I do the rest.
And you brought your lovely bride with you, Ms. Patrice Biddle. How you doing, my friend?
I'm well, thank you.
I try to tell people, I didn't know much about the Negro League. I watched Bingo Long and the Traveling All-Stars, a movie that Richard Pryor made with Billy Dee Williams. And that was my reference for Negro League, for the Negro League. And prior to me meeting you, Dennis, that was all I knew about Negro League baseball. And I know I'm not alone in that, because there wasn't a lot of, you know, public information about the Negro League and all that it wrought. But we're going to get right into it. And I want to talk a little bit about, first off, who is Dennis Biddle?
Well, I'm right now I'm a 90-year-old man from a little town in Arkansas, Magnolia, Arkansas, where I was born, where I was raised, went to school, graduated from high school there. And from there I went into professional baseball and for a short time.
But let me say this. I got to interrupt you because we're moving too fast. You're born in 1935.
Right, 1935.
1935. Take us on a journey. Okay. Those of us who weren't around during that time. Magnolia, well, Arkansas, 1935. What was that like growing up in that environment?
Magnolia was like 20 years behind time. It was a little country town. It was not in the country, but a country town. Country was outside of the city limits. We had a city limits population. 10,000. I made it 10,000, Earl. Was 9,999. When I was born, I made it 10,000.
Really?
Yeah. And I grew up there. It was a segregated town. I went to a segregated school. We stayed on one side of town, and whites was on the other side of town. We only came in contact with each other when we was uptown. Whoever went uptown to get something, we would see each other. But most of the time, we stayed to ourselves. Everything was, it was one, and I can remember one grocery store. Everybody in my section of town went to that one grocery store. And
Black and white.
Yes. And, you know, that was one school. Everybody went to that one school. Black went to that one school.
So what were the relationships like? I can only envision what I've read historically about the relationships in the South, especially in the 1930s. This is all prior to civil rights and all those kind of things. What did you do as a young man? Were you in the cotton fields?
Yeah, I picked cotton. As I remember as a young boy, my mother and father, mother never picked cotton. My daddy did. My daddy would take all of his five boys, and we would get in a truck and ride across to a little, about 10 miles outside of my hometown to Cottonfield. And that's where we, as young boys, we did. We picked cotton till school started. I can truthfully say that because once school started, we did not work in the long run. We worked until we got enough money to buy our school clothes for the year. And that's what we did every year.
So what were the relationships like between blacks and whites in Magnolia, Arkansas in 1935?
Well, like I said, you know, they stayed on one side of town, we stayed on the other side. Only time we communicated came in contact with them was if we worked at one of their facilities. My mom and dad worked for, my mother did work for a lady, and my daddy did mowed lawns at first. He was, he had a lot, he knew a lot of the white people.
Right.
You know, and it hurt me to see my daddy, to hear my daddy say, "Yes, sir," to a 14-year-old boy. That didn't seem like it was right to me. And I used to say, "Daddy, you don't have to do that." But you know, when I look back, he did have to do that. Yes. And so, you know, we knew our place, and we knew what to do and how to get along. And that was something that I just didn't understand why we had to go through the thing we had to go through, but I accepted it.
So Dennis, I think it's important before we even get into baseball and all those kind of things that we set a parameter and where people can kind of go back in their own minds to what you lived. Because there aren't a whole lot of people still around who can go back and talk about those times. But you are a guy who's educated and very well spoken. What was education like? You clearly were in a segregated school system.
Right.
And yet you did very well.
Well, you see, Earl, we accepted the way things were. I knew as a young man, a young boy, our books came from the white school. Everything that our school had came from the white school. It was hand-me-downs. We had to accept that. That's the way it was.
Right. You didn't know anything different.
Didn't know anything different. Right. And I often talk about my family being poor, you know. Jokingly,
right.
We were so poor. We were poor, poor as a more poor. But you know, I didn't know. I'd often talk about that now. I didn't know we were poor. I thought that's the way things were, right. You know, until later. But I'm grateful for the fact that I had the Lord on my side. We grew up in the church. That was family. Church was all family. And you learn to love each other, care for each other, look out for each other. Many times I had to get things in order for my younger brothers, help them do things that my sister, she was a cook, 10 years old. She cooked for all five boys, and my mom and dad was working. And, you know, life was great back then. We thought that's the way things were.
You know, people will say, how can it possibly be great? Those of us who, you know, born at a different time, what we don't understand is the simpler things in life, which are missing today. Family, being together, understanding the value. You grew up understanding the value of community and of family. Right. And so that's the only way that our people could survive.
That's right.
During these horrific historical facts about our nation. And I just think it's important that we get to know that part of Dennis Biddle before we get to all the accomplishments, because you've certainly been able to overcome all of those difficult times. Everybody was not able to overcome it.
No. You know, Earl, I often talk about jokingly.
Right.
I should see my grandmother standing by the stove ready to cook in case anything came. But that was really the truth. My dad would go hunting, and he would kill squirrels and rabbits. A lot of times that was meat in our family. One of my aunties, they had a cow, a milk cow, and she furnished milk for all the family and butter for the whole family. Sometimes we had to go down and churn the milk into butter. But that was a way of life for us. And I appreciate the fact that I had the opportunity to live through this. And now I can look back and see things that, well, a lot of people would have never recollected in their life.
Did your family own land?
No. My ancestors had land. We learned about this later on in life.
Your ancestors were slaves.
Yeah. And, but where we lived, we paid rent. I don't know how much my mom and dad was paying. Not that much.
Right.
Because they weren't making that much money. And we had no electricity at first. In my grade school, we had to do our homework by lamplight. And I was amazed when I looked back, all those cakes and biscuits my mother made, and that stove, a wooden stove. How did that happen? I couldn't figure that out. I could only say, if I had one of those stoves now, it would be worth $1,000.
Well, you know, Dennis, you clearly was a young man who, like many others before you and after you during those times, were up against insurmountable odds. What did you do for entertainment? What did you do for fun?
You know, as an early age...
There was no television.
No television. At an early age, we would take rattan. Rattan was a vine that you could take and do many
flexible,
shapes with it.
Flexible,
we would take that. We couldn't afford a basketball. We would take that and nail it to a board, and that would be the hoop. We had no ball. We had a milk can. That was the ball. As a young kid growing up, that's what we played with until somebody found a tennis ball. Then we started playing with the tennis ball. But that tennis ball led into baseball for me.
So how did you, first off, how did you even know about basketball? Because there was no television. How did you guys know that even existed?
We knew about sports. It was just automatic.
Right.
We see pictures and stuff.
Right.
And we didn't know how, as young, at real young age, how to, we made up our own rules.
Right.
You know, and those were the best rules. But back to that tennis ball, that led up to, we had no, that one, we never knew about Little League. We played it. We played. We knew the game, how to have our own rules.
Right.
But we never knew until we got into out of grade school the real basketball, the real baseball, the real softball, the real football. We played, like I said, with the and milk can up to a tennis ball, tennis ball up to. I often talk about this, and in my book I write about it. I'll never forget the day we saw a box in our gymnasium, a boxer that came from the white school.
Somebody
donated,
yeah.
Donated from the white school. And in that box they had basketball, baseball, gloves. And man, I ran, and I grabbed the baseball and glove. And another kid grabbed a glove, and some kids grabbed the basketball and bats.
Right.
But we started throwing, you know, throwing the ball. I started throwing the ball to the, and we started playing catch, and we did that for a long time until we started. Word got around that Jackie Robinson had opened the door. We knew about baseball because we had heard about Jackie. And what he had done, opening the door.
So, again, I got to slow you down.
Okay.
Because I want to, you became a really good athlete.
Yes.
And in sports, and good basketball player, baseball player.
Football
player. You had brothers.
Yes.
Were you the only one that was athletically inclined?
I had one brother that played football. Well, we all played against each other.
Yeah.
I remember my cousin named Jesse. Jesse, he was like me. He excelled in sports.
Right.
And he and I would play against all others. They would play against each, you know.
Right.
And so that was family ball, you know. But none of my brothers but one participated in sports in school. I guess I was gifted. I have to say that, Earl. I pick up a ball, I pick up football. I was gifted playing football, baseball, basketball. And I can truthfully say that and thank the Lord for giving me that gift. I can learn real fast sports, how to play the game.
So I saw a photo of you as a 15-year-old teen. Very tall and gangly and large hands. And so was it your body, do you think, that helped you along the way? The fact that were your other brothers as tall and
yes,
and
all of my brothers. You? My father was real tall. My father was about 6'10".
Wow.
And all of my brothers was in, I was 6 feet, a little over 6 feet.
At 15 years old.
At 15 years old. And, but before then, Earl, I played basketball. And that was the main sport at our school, basketball.
Right.
And then football came in there later on. But baseball never came until at the end. You know, like I was a junior. No, I was a freshman when I first knew about baseball. And when I got to be a junior, our coach was trying to have a baseball team at the school. And I had excelled. I was above the rest of them for baseball, catching and throwing.
Right.
I had developed a pitch. I was a pitcher. And the rest of them couldn't hit it.
So what was it about baseball? If you talk to a lot of young black boys today, and they were presented with an opportunity, and you gave them a baseball, a basketball, and a football, the baseball would come in last. They're going to grab the football or the basketball. What was it about that baseball that made you want to stick with baseball?
Okay, at an early age, I had read a book. This was a sport book, and I read about Sacha Pei and Jesse Owen and blacks in right. sports. And I was amazed that we could. I got a chance to do what they did, right. you know. Never forget Sacha Pei. I read about him. He had 1,000 different pitches.
Yeah.
I want to be a pitcher now, you know. And Jesse Owen, the things he had done.
Right.
So I was just, that book put me into sports. And I'll never forget my first that box. I grabbed that baseball because I knew that ball and a glove. I grabbed a glove and I kept it for a long time, that ball and the glove. But basketball was the main sport in our school. Right. Then the coach started trying to have a baseball team. Well, all other schools tried it too. And I was very successful there because I was above them.
Right.
I had developed a pitch. I call it a drop. They call them sinkers now and sliders in the major league. Right. But back then, those kids couldn't hit it. The ball would be on the ground and they swinging over it, you know. And I used that throughout my career, really. But back then, I gained respect from all the school.
Yeah.
Bill pitching today, hold on. We ain't going to get no hit today.
As a very young boy.
Yeah, real young. And so, once Jack had opened that door now, I felt that now we got a chance to play in the major league.
Well, Jackie opening the door is farther down the road from where I am with you. At 14 years old, you were being offered money to pitch and with adults.
Yeah, there was an adult team in my hometown. I did not know. I knew they had a team because I used to go watch them play.
Right.
Sneak and watch them play. But as I grew older and started playing myself, I was offered. They heard about me throwing that curveball, and the
owner of the
manager named Dan Shangerton, he offered me 75 cents if I would pitch the game for him that day, and I accepted, but I was supposed to be at church. Because I grew up in the church.
Right.
My mom and dad were very, very religious. And early in life, we were told playing ball was a sin. But they used that as a game, as gambling. And that was what they called right. a sin, you know. And finally, my brother told me, there ain't no sin to play ball. Once he told me that, that was it.
So 75 cents. Back then was a lot of money.
Yes, it was a lot of money. But I didn't get my first 75 cents because my dad
dreams
was supposed to go to church, and he came, got me out. I was warming up on the mound. I'll never forget it. I'm warming up, and he, come on, boy. And I had to go to church. I went to church. But the next week, the team was going to Spring Hill Louisiana. And he said, you go, I'll give you 75 cents. So I went, got my 75 cents that time. My dad never said anything else to me about playing ball. Earl, I was an all-star baseball, all-star basketball, all-star football player. And not one time did my parents see me play.
So what do you attribute that to? Was it that too hard to get to where you were playing, the fact that they had, you had other siblings, or that they just didn't believe in what you were doing?
Well, at first, it was a religious thing at first. And they finally said, well, he's going to play anyway. So they didn't bother me anymore about playing. But they were always throw up in my face because a white kid in football had got hit and died. And they used that as a dangerous sport. But they never told me not to play. They didn't. They tell me I'm going to do it now. They accepted the fact that I was going to play sports now. But they never, never came to see me play a game.
Okay, so here you are now. You're no longer this 14-year-old kid. How old were you when you first realized, and the teams realized that you were good enough to play professional baseball? How old were you then?
I was 16 years old. I knew I was good enough.
Yeah, but did the teams allow you to play? You're still in school.
Well, my team got to the, they had a little, call it the Farmers tournament. It was a tournament that.
Right.
On the weekend. All black schools.
On the weekend.
No, this was a tournament that I played in. Our team was in that tournament.
Yeah, still in
and
school.
And we won.
And you're still in school.
And I won the game. I pitched a no-hitter. And, you know, we won the tournament. We got a little trophy.
Right, right.
And but I got a call. I knew I was good enough, but I knew we couldn't play in the major league. After Jackie opened the door, then we had a chance.
But, so what did you know about the major leagues? There was no television.
Right.
And so, you know, the people that were playing at that time, I all knew, white, you.
Yeah. I knew we had heard that Jackie had opened the door. And blacks can now play in the major league. I put everything I had into baseball. But I still was an all-state basketball, football, and track. Still all-state. But I had a got ready to go to graduate from high school. What am I going to do? No one offered me a scholarship in baseball. I had scholarship offers in basketball and football. I'll never forget Eddie Robinson at Grambling College offered me a scholarship at Grambling. And he told me, he said, I heard about you, pretty good baseball player. He said, but we can't give you no scholarship in baseball, you know. And then he told me that if you play football, you can't play baseball, you won't be able to play baseball. And that kind of put a damp into my life a little bit as I look back. But, you know, I was going to take this college. I had a brother in college at that time, and I was helping. I get a little money helping him. And, you know, I talk about this, Earl. My brother in college, he was very educational. He excelled in education. He became the president of some sorority.
Right.
And that was all in the newspaper. The newspapers every week had something in there about me. Many scores I scored, the no-hitter I pitched, the touchdowns I threw in football. But that wasn't, that did not overshadow my brothers in my family.
Yeah.
And I think that that's something that my mother, she reacted later on because of that. Because, you know, in my book I talk about when I left home to go play baseball. But Eddie Robinson, I think I kind of heard him. He had recruited me for quarterback. And he could have recruited someone else. But when I called and told him I was going, I'd gotten a call from Chicago to play baseball in the Negro League, because I didn't know nothing about the Negro League. But he said, Jack has opened the door, son. So if baseball is what you want to do, you should go for it. You got a chance now.
So you as a young boy, never got a chance to see a big league game. Is it safe to say that?
No.
Okay, so you never got to see a big league game. But you did get to play against some legendary Negro League ball players. Who are some of the names of the legendary ball players you got to play against?
You know.
And let's before I go there, when did the Negro League start? Do you have any idea when the Negro League started officially?
Oh, I knew that. I learned that it started in 1920. But before that, Earl, black men were playing in the major leagues. I didn't know that until later on. There were a lot of black men playing in the major leagues. So I looked into that, and I came up with names like Moses Fleetwood Walker and a lot of other guys. But what happened is they kicked them out. And I use that word loosely. They just threw them out. And the way they did it, the way it was done is what gets me. All the owners got into a room and they voted that they would not hire another black man to play on the team. And like overnight, all the great black ball players that was playing in the Negro League and the Major League disappeared, and in the minor leagues too. And you didn't hear much about it until 20 years later, 1920, when Rube Foster decided we got enough team, we can have our own Major League.
Well, you know, it's pretty safe to say that going back to the times in the history of our nation and what was taking place in those times, there was probably outcry from white players and their families that black men were taking the jobs
that was
white
in the
players.
Beginning. That was in the beginning. There were problems with the players and the team itself, because If you're the manager of a baseball team and you want to win, you want the best player you can get, right? So somehow the black players excel faster than the white players. I don't know why, but this was the thought in the beginning. If we don't, you know, a black player was coming into the major leagues and increasing numbers. So they had to stop that influx. And the way they stopped it is like I told you. But later on in life, if you're a ball player, you feel you're good, you compete against another guy that's better than you, you're better than him.
Right.
You know, competition. The ball players themselves, and I'm going to say a majority of them, did not care.
Yeah, but it wasn't about the players, it was about the audience.
It was about
the people, the fans.
It was about the fans.
Yeah.
They did not like to see black and white men playing together because of segregation.
Right.
And now that was the big thing.
And let me say, too, they also, they had to maintain that inferiority complex.
Right.
And because the black men were excelling, that brought a certain amount of superiority, athletically at least, that they were not able to accept. Right. So they could not allow that to continue because they had to maintain that superiority complex.
Yeah.
And so, but what's so interesting is when they did this, they called it the gentleman's agreement. That's what it was referred to in history books. It's referred to as the gentleman's agreement, where all the managers and the corporations got together and decided amongst themselves that they were no longer hire blacks in the major leagues. Well, as a result of that, because it wasn't a law, it became law.
Right.
It became legal to do so, which therefore caused businesses, schools, stores, restaurants to now say, well, we won't discriminate. We don't have to have blacks come in our store. We don't have to have them in our school, which therefore became the beginning of segregation in America. So that was catapulted as a result of that gentleman's agreement, which is very interesting, the significance of Negro League baseball to segregation in America.
So part of the reason why I wanted to go slow with Dennis is because of all that historical information that we're talking about now.
Mm-hmm.
We want to make sure we cover those things in this series and for people. This is just the beginning of our conversation. You might be wondering, well, you didn't even get into the Negro. Well, because all of this history is tied into the history of this nation, and not just in sports, but the history of the nation. And that's what we want to make sure we capture in this podcast series. And so, you know, we're gonna crawl. And I know Dennis wants to get right into it, but we're going to slow him down a little bit, but go ahead.
I want to say something else about that era, okay? Pre-segregation or pre-Negro League era, where Moses Fleetwood Walker was one of the major league players he played. He was a professional baseball player in the major leagues during pre-1920s, before Negro League was established. Also, another player was Bud Fowler, who was also in that era of a professional player. But I want to speak a little about Moses Fleetwood Walker, a little bit about his character, the type of black man he was in that era. So he came up, his mother and father were educated. He came up very educated, kind of middle class, actually, in that era.
Right.
And so he, as a baseball player, when they began to dismantle that system of integrated baseball.
Right.
So the ones that were still left after they decided they were not going to hire anymore, they had to find a way to get rid of the ones. So they made conditions so bad that they ended up leaving or quitting or harming or dying. What his instance was, he was being threatened, right, by some fans or whoever. And I guess some kind of way he ended up stabbing one of the people who was threatening him or came after him or out of self-defense. This man, pre-1920s, represented himself in court and won. He won the case. This man wrote a book. He was an author. And he also was an inventor. He invented some component of the rifle, right? So just looking at the type of character, the type of charisma that he had in the era just coming out of slavery, right? Segregation and before the Negro League started, just to kind of shine some light on the type of character and person that this man was. He was more than just a baseball player, professional baseball player.
So what we're going to do is we're going to stick a pin in it for now until we come back the second and third and fourth and however long it takes to tell this intriguing history. I don't want to call it a story because it's real life. It's not a story. It's real life. And, you know, my thing is, you know, I'm a guy who always follow sports, and they always call baseball America's game. America's game.
Greatest pastime.
Yeah, they didn't call basketball or football that. And so this is kind of like that's a sacred American pastime. Sacred.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about people who were not given an opportunity, American citizens who were not given an opportunity to participate. And that's what this history is, and that's what this history should never be forgotten as we talk about where it is. And Dennis, you are the key to the vault. And so we're going to use your eloquence and your really great recall. I mean, man, I have trouble remembering yesterday, but you can go back and eloquently speak on it. So we're going to put a pen in it for now. But, you know, chapter two is right around the corner, and we're going to continue this, what I think is national story on Mr. Dennis Biddle and Negro League Baseball. So many different chapters to come. Thank you very much, Mrs. Biddle.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dennis.
Thank you.
And we will be getting right back at it soon. Thank all of you for listening.
Looking forward.